You already know the ending to this story.
We're going to change it.
Yeah, baby!
Please, open your eyes.
Take this.
Remember who you answer to.
What is your name?
This is where it kind of goes off the deep end.
Welcome to Movie Land with CJ Johnson on ABC Local Radio, digital and online.
Hi, how are you? This week on Movie Land, I chat with Thomas Lennon. He's a writer of films that have made more than $1 billion at the box office, including Night at the Museum. I talk with Thomas at his home in Hollywood about juggling writing for the masses and keeping his alternative comedy cred. Plus, I talk with Andrew Leovold, who is making a documentary about the lost Filipino midget James Bond, the legendary Weng Weng. Thomas Lennon and his writing partner Ben Garant have together earned over $1 billion at the box office, or at least their movies have. Their films include Night at the Museum, Reno 911, Balls of Fury, Taxi, The Pacifier, and Herbie Fully Loaded, and the upcoming Baywatch. They write movies for the mass market, yet both are alternative comedians with secondary niche audiences. I spoke with Thomas at his home in Hollywood about his many different entertainment identities, which include being a very successful comedic character actor and now director of indie film Hell Baby.
Thomas Lennon has written or co-written many movies, including Reno 911, Miami, which is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen, Night at the Museum, and Herbie Fully Loaded. A movie he's written, Baywatch, is in pre-production, and a film he's written and directed, Hell Baby, is entering its distribution year. He's also an unbelievably prolific actor, mainly in guest spots, both in television and film, and having not seen Tom in a while, I have to ask you first, Tom, you popped up huge on the IMAX screen, to my delight, my total delight, in The Dark Knight Rises as a doctor, and you also play a doctor in Memento. Are you a Christopher Nolan in-joke?
He layers this stuff a lot. Have you ever seen, I think maybe his best film is called Following?
No, I haven't seen Following.
Amazing. The movie, that's a movie before Memento.
Yeah.
But weirdly, there's a huge Batman logo in the middle of the movie. Like, this is, and I'm talking 15 years before he ever becomes associated with the Batman franchise. It's just interesting. He's crazy smart. Yeah. Whenever I'm in like a serious film, which only very infrequently happens, I really love how much I'm ruining it for people that know me. Because like, if you know me, the second you see The Dark Knight Rises, you're like, oh, this is all fake. That guy's, oh, that, I know that idiot. Yeah. So I really do enjoy it. And especially Memento, because Memento is truly like a work of art. That's a beautiful movie. And then I pop in and I'm like, hey, guys. Ruining big, epic, beautiful films is one of my favorite things.
So tell us about Hell Baby.
Not extraordinary for a movie to take 6 or 7 or 8 years to get made.
Right.
We'll be fired off our own scripts over and over again, replaced by our best friends. Then they will be fired and hopefully we get to replace them, as sometimes happens. But it will make you crazy. And we'd done a couple of TV projects, Reno 911, which seems to be pretty popular in Australia. I got a picture of 7 or 8 big, hunky Australian guys dressed up like Lieutenant Dangle at some event.
Really?
Yeah. So I guess the show does well down there, it seems like. TV was making us crazy. Movies were making us crazy. And we'd never really made an independent film. Hell Baby is honestly the first time really ever where we've made a film, the trailer is online now, it will be by the time this airs, I think, with absolutely no committee involved whatsoever. So we went, Millennium is releasing the film, and Darko financed it, but it's a very, it's like a $2 million movie, it was a very inexpensive film, shot in basically two different houses in New Orleans that were a block away from each other.
Why'd you shoot in New Orleans? Is the tax incentive?
Incentive is fantastic, yeah. But two, we also wanted a little bit of personality to it. There's a very strange character named Fresnel, played by Keegan-Michael Key, who lives maybe in the crawl space of the house. We don't know if he's a neighbor or if he just lives in the crawl space. And we wanted it to have a little more flavor. And we were able to find a truly crazy looking house. Well, you drive around New Orleans and you'll see these, you know, like these mansions that are, you know, I mean, everything looks like a haunted mansion down there, which is fun. Also, it's a very fun place to make a film.
I'm sure.
And to scout a film. And yeah, if you don't mind, you'll put on a ton of weight. Yeah. You never have to set down your drink ever. You can literally ride around on your bicycle with a gin and tonic or a Sazerac in your hand. It's totally acceptable and sort of expected.
Yeah. So what is it? Is it a horror comedy?
It is. It's mostly a comedy, I guess. It's our effort to make a totally sincere movie that will scare you a couple of times, but I think for the most part is pretty funny. If you've read the book that we wrote, the technical name of the book is Writing Movies for Profit. Because the words fun and are on the cover, so it looks like the title is Writing Movies for Fun and Profit, but we've crossed out fun and left just the profit part, because it's much more about the aspect that no one has written about ever, which is how do you survive in the studio system, which is a completely insane system. It's crazy.
Yeah, you actually talk about the nuts and bolts of day-to-day existence as a writer, and how to read where they send you to park, and all of this stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot to know about it. There's a ton of pitfalls, and that's the thing. We were looking around at the screenwriting books, you know, like Robert McKee, who he's got a great, terrific book. But if you look at McKee's screenwriting credits, you're like, I hate to say those who can't teach, but if you know so much about writing successful movies, why don't you write one?
Because his only
credit is for a TV movie called Barbie and the Dream Castle, I believe. You can look it up. We looked it up.
I bet it really adheres to what he teaches.
I'm sure it does. But it was, we were kind of annoyed by that. And in the beginning of the book, we say, how are all these people screenwriting gurus when none of them have ever sold more than maybe one screenplay or have half of a credit on a film? If you're not a guru of something that you are not good at. And I'm not saying our films are good. I'm saying we've survived. Some of our films are egregiously terrible and some are terrific. But what I can say is we've survived in the studio system for a very long time, which is almost impossible. And we've gotten, I guess now 11 films made and a couple in pre-production now. So, you know, by next year, maybe 12 or 13 or 14 films made. So we do know whether or not we know how to write a good film. We know how the sausages are made and how to not get yourself made into sausage, I guess, is mostly sort of what the book's about.
Yeah. Have you actually ever been hired to replace yourself?
We've often joked about, because we know the sort of approved studio screenwriters group is rather small.
Right.
And we've joked about, like, when we've been offered to rewrite a friend's script, just, you know, take a finder's fee and then tell that buddy, hey, do you want to just do the rewrite yourself since it's your script already? And we'll just put our name on it, hand it back to you, and then you can do the same for us next time. And we won't tell anybody, because the studio just wants fresh eyes, is what they call it. That's a big thing in our book. They always, they love to get fresh eyes on your script. Which means
replacing you.
You're fired. Right. Yeah. The nice way studio people tell you you're fired is like, you know what, we really just want to get a pair of fresh eyes in here. Which is another reason why we always say, always turn in your scripts to the studios as locked PDF files.
Right.
Always. So, because then when they call you, they'll want a copy in the program called Final Draft, which is the way you can change it.
Yeah.
And we have many times found out that we're fired off the movie by some assistant calling and said, hey, could we just get a Final Draft copy of your script? Would that be okay? And then you always know there's a slight pause as you think, oh, okay. We're fired.
Because if they send you this script that someone else has written that they're not happy with, and you're the fresh eyes, so they want you and Ben to have a look at it, then you do your rewrite and you send it back to them as a locked file. When they read it, how are they comparing the changes?
One thing you usually mark them, when you're doing a production rewrite, you actually do have to send them a final draft copy, which is dangerous.
So that they can see the changes.
Exactly. Right. Although production rewrites are, if you can get them, they are the best job in the world. A movie that is either shooting right now or is about to be shooting, and the studio comes to you. This happens all the time. Ben and I rewrote, I'm not bragging. I should clarify to your listeners, most of the time I'm not bragging.
Okay. Yeah.
We wrote, in about 10 days, we entirely rewrote a Martin Lawrence movie called Rebound, where he's like a college basketball coach or something.
Right.
An egregious turd.
Yeah,
I'm sure. Even the good version, I've never seen it.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot of my work I've not seen.
Really?
Yeah. If you do the kind of work I do, some of it you just have to skip.
Right, okay.
Yeah, because it's not all great. Mm-hmm. That was funny because they had scouted the movie. They had all the locations. They started shooting in 10 days. And the studio, and this happens more than you would think, hated every word of the script. They had loved the original idea, hated the script that they had. But these things, again, these are big things that once they start moving, you know, and so often you'll sit at a movie studio and you'll be like, well, wait, so should we just stop? But you can't stop it now.
Yeah.
It's an aircraft carrier. It takes 5 miles to turn it around. So a movie like Hellbaby was great to do movies without committees. As soon as you have a committee, everyone sort of has given up on fighting. And now they have this sort of strange, mediocre product that's moving forward that no one can stop.
Yeah.
And yet what they've all vetoed and they've made weird decisions to, it's already a disaster, yeah. But it's going, yeah. You know, and it starts in 10 days through, I mean, the way to not make art is committees, which is a trick of the studio system because there's so many committees involved. But so we had 10 days to start, write an entire new movie, but we had to keep every single one of the scene headings that said, because all the sets
were
built or scouted. So that was fun. We like to do production rewrites because that's when everyone's panicking. And weirdly, you can get so much of your work into a film, and like especially in comedies, you can get so much of your sense of humor into films because you're faxing them pages they have to shoot tomorrow.
Right.
You know, there is no option. I really love that.
That sounds fun. Have you done a lot of those?
Oh, we do a lot of production rewrites. The other thing about production rewrites, they're awful. You stay up all night and you'll need to like do 3 or 4 versions of a scene for the next day sometimes. But it's also it's probably the best paying job in Hollywood. Other than being a huge movie star, it is pretty much the best job in Hollywood.
Because they're desperate.
They're desperate. Yeah. They are literally, you got to talk them down off a ledge because they're shooting a movie they hate.
I was in Singapore and I saw Balls of Fury merchandise everywhere, all over the streets. Was that merchandise available anywhere else, or was that an Asian thing?
I think that was an Asian thing, because there was nothing here. That's really hilarious. That must have been just an Asia thing.
I think so, because obviously there's a lot of ping pong played in Asia.
And I'm guessing Maggie Q was on the stuff over there, yeah.
She was, but all the characters were.
Oh, fun.
Like, I remember there was some sort of sweet thing you could buy that was balls of sweet things. And they came in these cups, and these cups had the different characters on them.
Oh, man, I love that. No, I never knew about that. It's so funny, the things you see in other markets. I was in London. The studios are always so obsessed with pirating films.
Yeah.
And as well they should be, because, I mean, like, the Reno 911 movie was posted in its entirety online the morning that it came out in the United States by some sinister dude in Canada who I sent an email to, and I was like, just so you know, you've basically stolen, like, I don't care about them, not that you're stealing money, but you've stolen a year of my life.
How did you find out about him?
It was just posted. He had a link in his website and you could email him, so I did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But and then I was in London, and a young man came up to me on the street with a stack of DVDs, of bootleg DVDs for sale, pirated DVDs, and I was in 2 of the movies, and I had written one of them, and so I had my photo taken with all the bootleg movies on sale. Yeah, in a nice neighborhood in London. Yeah.
But was Balls of Fury an independent film?
No, Balls was a studio movie. It was a small studio movie. It was not a big budget movie, as you can probably tell by
it had an indie feel.
The cheesy special. That's just because the special effects are bad.
Yeah.
And some of my acting is questionable.
No, I thought you were terrific in that. And Walken was in there.
Walken was in that. He is a lot of fun. You don't know what to expect. We had to call, when we were making that film, we had to call Christopher Walken at home, you know, because we'd received word, they're like, oh, he likes the script and he wants to do it. I was real, real stressed out. And I was given, someone handed me, they're like, well, here's the phone number. Just call him. And I was like, oh, I really don't want to do that. It was like, honestly, it's the most nervous I've ever been in show business, was calling Christopher Walken at home. I was just like, this is going to be weird. And it just rings a bunch of times. Oh, hi. Yeah. And there's a guy, you know, it was a lot of fun. The only twist to it is his face, when his face is resting, he looks like he's about to bite your nose off all the time. His resting face can never, I mean, he just looks like a half-asleep barracuda who, if you nudge it, is something terrible is going to happen.
When he and Michael Shannon make their movie together, it's just going to be brilliant.
Someone should just cut together reaction shots of Michael Shannon and Christopher Walken in a film called Reaction Shot.
Now, you turned up in kind of a big role in a big Hollywood mainstream movie, What to Expect When You're Expecting.
Yeah.
That seemed like a departure for you.
That was, you know, my friend Rob Hubel had been, they wanted all the dads to be, you know, sort of funny comedy guys around Chris Rock. And so my good friend Rob Hubel, who's also in Hellbaby, and we worked together a ton, he's from the comedy group Human Giant, he was going to do it, and he called me up, and he said, they want you, but you should really do it. And I was like, I don't know, man. It seems pretty silly. Like, I care. Yeah, you've seen me. Like, I care. So I was like, But I was like, this one seems really silly. Even for me, it seems pretty silly. And I wasn't really sure about the character.
You guys were a bunch of dads with group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, crabby dads walking around with, you know, with the baby spit up on us. And we're just, you know. So he said to me on the phone, Rob says, look, you know, all our alternative comedy fan base will never see movies like this. It doesn't matter. Just come and do it. We'll go down to Atlanta for a couple weeks. We'll have a blast. And it won't hurt our credibility at all. And I never forgot that he said it won't hurt our credibility, because we did go down to Atlanta, and like basically like a week later, he and I were jumping around on stage with Jennifer Lopez singing Don't You Want a Baby to the tune of Don't You Want Me, Baby. And I remember thinking, you know, this actually could hurt my credibility. You know, there's a solid chance this might actually do it. This might be the straw that broke the camel's back of my alternative comedy cred. You know, like as a writer in Hollywood, you are somewhere in the middle to the lower middle of the totem pole, and often replaced, and often they don't care what you think. And they often, while legally you're required, they're required to offer you a set visit.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
One. But they don't like to do it, and they don't have to give it to you, because, of course, the writer is just going to stand around and go, oh, but wait, just don't, you're ruining my, oh, wait, stop, everything, you know.
But how did you find the experience of directing your first feature?
You know, everybody always says, I want to direct. What I really want to do is direct. I mean, it's become a joke, the I really want to direct. I think anybody who's directed a studio film, whether it went well or went badly, and wants to do it again, is probably slightly insane. Mm. It's as much as I joke that writers, studio writers, is a sort of a bad job, and no one cares what you think, and they fire you all the time. Director, studio movie director, I almost would not wish on my worst enemy.
Right.
Everybody's mad at you all the time.
Oh,
the studio's mad at you. You're already behind schedule. You know, the sexiness of like sitting like Hitchcock in a chair with like a cone that you're yelling, cut, action. No, what you're mostly doing when you're directing studio movies is sitting in an awful passenger van with a bunch of people driving around looking at terrible locations to film. And yet, you know, if you're directing big studio movies, you know, and you're directing hits, it's a huge paycheck. But $10 million to direct a studio movie, yeah, that's what you'd have to pay someone, because otherwise they're insane to do it. The studios are publicly traded companies.
Right.
So these are not privately held things. These are News Corp and Viacom. And even DreamWorks is a publicly traded company. You, if you're working for them, you need to be delivering hits that people want to go see. That's a huge amount of pressure. And honestly, even writing studio movies like that. For me right now, the Baywatch film is done.
Right.
Because the script is done.
Yeah.
So in my head, it's done. It's great. And it's a great feeling. But of course, nothing has even started on it yet. So. Right.
What is it? Is it like Starsky and Hutch, like a comedy?
It is a comedy that takes itself very seriously.
Right.
In fact, the working title right now is called Baywatch Red Tide, with a colon, just because we wanted to act as deadly serious about it as we could, and also imply that we're going to make 5 or 6 or 7 of them.
Right. Or even that this one is number 3 already.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, we almost called Hellbaby 2.
That would be great.
I thought so too, and then our attorney said, you're insane, and he wouldn't let us do it. We're like, oh, let's call it Hellbaby 2, or even Hellbaby 2 The Reckoning, or something like that. So it just felt like people were like, wait, did I miss? And we were going to even do interviews and say, you know what, we made a Hellbaby 1, but it was unreleasable. So, yeah. But I thought it was a great idea, too.
I think it's great.
We got talked out of it.
Thomas Lennon, thank you very much.
A pleasure, my old friend.
This is Movie Land with CJ Johnson.
Andrew Leopold is in post-production on a documentary he's been making about Weng Weng over at least a decade. Who, may you ask, is Weng Weng?
Weng Weng was the 2'9" James Bond of the Philippines, who starred in a series of James Bond knockoffs. It turns out quite a large number of them. And one of them, For Your Hide Only, managed to appear on VHS in the early 80s in Australia. And leads me 20-something years later to almost finishing the 7 years in the making opus. I remember dreaming, I think in the late 90s, that I was in Manila on the phone with a video camera in one hand and the phone in the other, saying, my name's Andrew Leopold, I'm here in Manila making a documentary about Weng Weng. And woke up the next morning and thought, what a great idea. and then 10 years later, I was in Manila with a phone in one hand and a camera in the other, only to find that most of the people who worked with Wang Wang had never even knew his real name and didn't even know if he was alive or not. So it really did become a quest, you know, for the truth. When I first went there, I think I'd seen two Wang Wang films, and there was rumors of a midget spy western called Da Best in Da West. It turned out on my first trip that I literally bumped into the editor of Wang Wang's films, and he said, oh no, there are 10 of them. And all of a sudden the alarm bell started going off, and I thought, my God, I've got to dig even deeper. And it took several more trips to the Philippines to actually find out that there were in fact 12 Wang Wang films, half of which I've seen now, and the other half are probably sitting in, you know, the dungeon of a mansion somewhere in Manila. And so there's this mountain of misinformation about Wang Wang, and had been generated since the 90s, since even before the internet was around. Because there were no facts, people had to fill in the gaps by themselves. And so the misinformation then becomes the only information. I ended up going through a series of people from Wang Wang's editor to Wang Wang's director, the guy who made Da Wild Wild Wang and The Cute, The Sexy and The Tiny and For Your Hide Only and its various sequels. Even he didn't know Wang Wang's real name. He said, I think his name was Ernesto. And then I asked him, is he dead? He said, oh, I think so. I'm not too sure. But a couple of days after the meeting with Eddie, I came face to face with the only surviving relative of Wang Wang. And he then was able to show me a birth certificate with his name and date of birth on it. And also, unfortunately, a death certificate. He then drove me to the grave, and it was an eerie feeling putting my hand on a very simple concrete tomb in Pasay City Cemetery and realizing that I had literally gotten as close as possible to Wang Wang. And luckily, of course, all of that was caught on film. I mean, I just happened to have a three-chip video camera at the time, and I was recording everything because I knew that at some point, you know, the truth would suddenly, you know, fly out like a karate kicking James Bond and smack me in the face. Around about 20 years ago that I first became aware of an entire subculture of a cult movie called the Filipino B film. And it wasn't just, you know, 2 Foot 9 James Bond knockoffs. It was also, you know, kung fu spy films called They Call Her Cleopatra Wong and The One-Armed Executioner and, you know, sort of gay biker satanic post-apocalypse films called W is War. More I dug, the more started coming to the surface, and I realized that there was an entire industry churning out copies of Hollywood product and recycling ideas from Western pop culture and putting their own spin on it and producing this incredible hybrid, the Pinoy B film or the Filipino B film, which was just so bizarre and truly exotic. And I knew there had to be more. And so to go to the Philippines and start digging up these Tagalog language B films, it's been an absolute trip. And they still keep coming to the surface. Like, for instance, the Filipino E.T. There's a film called Little Boy Blue that's about this sort of scrotum-shaped alien that lands on Earth, discovers Jesus, becomes Catholic, and then takes a rosary back in his spaceship to the stars, spreading Catholicism to the universe. It's absolutely insane. There's a musical that Wang Wang was in that also starred the Filipino version of the Village People. It's a film called Legs Katawan Babae, one of the lost Wang Wang films. That film actually came to the surface last week, and it's winging its way on DVD to me right now. If I can show you footage of a Filipino village people with Wang Wang out the front draped in bikini babes, I think that is going to be one of the money shots of the documentary.
That's Movieland for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. The music you heard was from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Movieland page and on Twitter at CJ Movieland. and find my book. It's called And the Oscar Didn't Go To. It's a history of all those Oscar films and Oscar people who didn't win Oscars. Find it on Amazon, iTunes, Kobo, Sony, Barnes & Noble, or any fine ebook store. Buy it, read it, enjoy it, and then go see a movie. Bye-bye.